welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about all of the battles playing out in politics here in the United States. We've got a great show for you, and a little bit later in the show, we will also have some words we were able to get with former Congressman Dennis Kucinich about some of those things as well. But before we can move on, when the courts put a stop to Donald Trump's immigration order, which drew furor over the issue of whether it was or wasn't a Muslim ban, the issue of whether or not Trump's policies on down the line would face trouble in front of the courts was also raised. Groups like the ACLU vowed to sue frequently and drew quite a bit of money in donations to make that possible. Well, in the next few months, sometime before June, there are a few cases where rulings will come out from the Supreme Court that I think are worth keeping an eye on that could dramatically affect what President Trump actually is able to do, or perhaps precipitate some sort of other crisis. First is the case of Jennings v. Rodriguez, which deals with the issue of whether or not immigrants must have a chance to have a hearing where the government justifies their imprisonment while they're essentially fighting a case on whether or not they'll be deported. It's a bigger deal than it seems because many people who are arrested and put through deportation proceedings actually won't be deported and certainly aren't any sort of risk. And in fact, many people who are lawful permanent residents, asylum seekers, victims of torture and the like are those who get caught up in this. They're clearly no sort of risk, but they're often held for months, even years, as the court decides their legal status. The ACLU, which is fighting this case, tells the story of Arnold Giammarco, who is a lawful resident of the United States for 50 years. He was a veteran of the U.S. Army. And then after his first marriage collapsed, he had a drug problem that developed and he got arrested for possession and for shoplifting. He went to jail, served his time, left jail, started a whole new life, a whole new family. Then when applying for a job, it triggered a background check that caused ICE to arrest him and try to deport him for the shoplifting charge and the drug possession that were not only literally years old, but again, for which he had already served time in prison. Originally from Italy, but brought here when he was four, Giammarco was hobbled by his inability to work and unable to develop the resources to really be able to fight his case, and ultimately accepted deportation to Italy, where he barely speaks the language, to spare his wife and child the legal expense. A judge had the chance, could have easily released him, like many, many citizens charged with much worse crimes are released while they are fighting their case. Immigrants, however, do not have a right to a hearing where a judge can consider mitigating factors and allow release pending trial. Now, the ACLU won a decision at the lower court saying after 6 months, a hearing must be held. The government, of course, then challenged that. And now the ruling in Jennings v. Rodriguez will show whether or not the government has to hold these hearings. And if they do, it could significantly increase the time it takes to deport people. And there's already a big backlog in terms of deportation proceedings and immigration court in general. And so Trump's plans to try to get rid of a lot of people really quick would be certainly hobbled. The other cases are also relevant. In one, the Supreme Court will decide if the parents of Sergio Hernandez, who live in Mexico and are Mexicans, can sue the Border Patrol for murdering their 15-year-old son under the U.S. Constitution as an excessive use of force. Hernandez and his friends were playing around right at the border there in Mexico. And on a dare, a couple of them ran across to touch the fence on the U.S. side. A Border Patrol agent grabbed one of them. Sergio, however, ran and made it back to the Mexican side about 60 feet away. The border guard then shot him in the head and killed him. His parents want to sue that this was excessive force under the U.S. Constitution. The Supreme Court is deciding if they can. And given that Trump is proposing 5,000 new Border Patrol agents, a wall, and other forms of increased border militarization, it seems fairly clear that this is a situation that could happen again, and thus the implications are quite significant in terms of the actions of border guards. And the final case involves whether or not a group of Muslim, South Asian, and Arab non-citizens can sue top Bush administration officials for rounding them up post 9/11 on the basis of their race and or religion. The government under the Obama administration argued that senior officials shouldn't be held liable for these actions and that the upshot would be that senior officials could actually be held accountable for their impact of their actions on an overall basis. So essentially what's at stake here is whether or not senior U.S. officials face any repercussions if their actions lead to negative consequences further down the line. Right now, they don't specifically. In this case, we'll decide if they will, and obviously could have deep implications on policies related not only to Muslim immigrants, but people around the world that are subject to many of these policies that are determined here in Washington. Now, given the reaction so far by President Trump to the court responses to his different orders already, we should look for more anger from President Trump if these ones don't go his way either. President Trump yesterday signed an order that eliminates the stream protection rule put in place by President Obama at the end of his last term. The stream protection rule helps to stop the dumping of the toxic leftovers from mountaintop removal coal mining being dumped into streams. Over 2,000 miles of streams have actually been buried this way, and as one might expect, the results we do have from health studies are that water is being poisoned in the areas where a lot of this coal dumping takes place. The rule, which is quite complicated, was more or less a compromise. It limits the ability of coal mining companies to dump this debris, but has enough gray area that the exact meaning of it is not totally clear, and there may be some loopholes, maybe not, in areas where companies could be held accountable through some creative reasoning. Trump campaigned on reviving coal, which is probably impossible, but either way, despite this rule having very little effect on the coal industry itself, it really is the low-hanging fruit that is much easier to get rid of than some of the broader regulations on coal-fired plants put in place during the Obama years. So ultimately, at the end of the day, this is just another sacrifice to the fossil fuel gods by the Trump administration. It appears Trump doesn't want to take a chance with his new nominee for Labor Secretary getting blocked, so he chose a law professor who's been confirmed by the Senate before for government jobs and who, shockingly for Trump nominees, has experience in the actual area in which he would be overseeing. Trump has picked R. Alexander Acosta, the dean of Florida International University's College of Law. Acosta served for 2 years on the National Labor Relations Board under George W. Bush, which is the relevant experience primarily, and he was also a federal prosecutor. Acosta headed up the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division under Bush when they de-emphasized things like voting rights cases and got in trouble from their own inspector general for seeming to hire people purely on the basis of their right-wing bona fides. Acosta, as a prosecutor at the federal level, did take on some major corruption cases and was known for being tough on health care fraud, which is a huge issue in Florida. And by the way, the current governor of Florida, Rick Scott, once headed up a health care company that committed billions of dollars in health care fraud. Be that as it may, Acosta also gained accolades for speaking out openly against the criminalization of all Muslims as terrorists. Acosta, however, does have some pretty serious black marks in addition to the DOJ thing I mentioned earlier. In 2004, while he was at the DOJ, he actually wrote a letter to a judge in Ohio backing voter suppression efforts. They weren't a party to the case, so he went out of his way to make sure that he sent this letter on behalf of the DOJ. And Acosta was also involved in the sweetheart deal given to billionaire Jeffrey Epstein after he got caught red-handed running a child sex ring, reputedly one that was at least known to high-level politicians like Donald Trump and Bill Clinton and other bold-faced names. Despite having sex with dozens of underage girls, Epstein was allowed to plead to 18 months in prison. Basically, it was a club-fed, club-med prison-type situation for which the state was actually criticized for taking it too easy on him. Many have critiqued Acosta for this, and the government is now a party in the suit from two of Epstein's victims that claim the deal violated their rights as victims. So more on that likely to come out. On the whole, then, Acosta seems like a fairly run-of-the-mill Republican with relevant experience and solidly right-wing views, which means he will most likely be confirmed. It also seems fair to expect that despite his lack of colorful statements and extensively disgusting background like Pudster, Acosta almost certainly will uphold the same general anti-worker provisions either way. So while it's clear the defeat of Pudster should be seen as a victory for working people who put pressure on the Senate, advocates of workers' rights aren't out of the woods yet. And finally, we've argued fairly extensively on this show that voter ID laws are really about reducing the voting power of the black community, other communities of color, and poor people in general. Now, a new study that comes out seems to reflect this assumed reality back to us as a basic truth. The study measures voter turnout by race and finds that in states with strict voter ID, turnout among Latinos is about 7% lower in general elections than in the non-strict voter ID states, while black voter turnout is about 3% lower and white voter turnout is more or less the same. So clearly, voter ID is disproportionately targeting communities of color, which was pretty transparent as anything else on earth really could be when one examined the whole context around voter ID laws. But just add this study to the bank of evidence proving that voter ID is not about election integrity. It's about voter suppression. And those are today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are joined in our studio to continue our conversation by Garland Nixon, who's the host of News Views with Garland Nixon on WPFW 89.3 FM in D.C. and on their website Around the World Live. And Mike Hirsch, who's the National Communications Director at Progressive Democrats of America. Thank you both so much for joining the show.
Thank you. And you left out. I'm also a member of the National Board of Directors for the ACLU.
Man, there it is. Garland Nixon has so many superlatives. We just can't even list them all because then we'd be here all day. But he does quite a bit of excellent work in the state of Maryland, D.C., and around the country. Big news in some ways, or I guess the big rumor that has everyone talking today, is whether or not Trump is going to try to mobilize lots of National Guard soldiers on the border around immigration. It's not really a new idea. I think Mitt Romney actually campaigned him on this in 2012 as one of his secure the border things. But whatever. Similar situation as when they said they were going to revive the black sites. Some news group gets a hold of a memo. They report it. The White House says, oh, that's not true. And so, I mean, my question about this whole thing is not even really the National Guard piece. We'll see what happens. But I'll start with you, Garland. I mean, are these things being leaked by someone inside who doesn't like Trump, do you think? Or is it maybe just one of these, like, administration ploys where they're putting out these things like this to keep people off balance?
You know, I think there's just so much disarray in there that all of the above are true. I think there are people in the Trump administration that are just so incompetent and blabbermouth that they say whatever they think is going to make them look good, or they talk to their buddies. I think there are people on the inside who are leaking, you know, their deliberate leaks, such as the border guards, which, let's face it, putting a bunch of the issue with immigration is not people coming across the border anymore, you know, running across the border at night or coming through tunnels. Mm-hmm. The issues that we're dealing with are people who are here and how we're going to deal with the fact that there are people who, you know, such as the Dreamers and et cetera, and how people are going to be treated and whether or not people have human rights as opposed to only interpreting people as constitutional rights and legal rights, but interpreting them through the prism of human rights. So there are a lot of other issues here, and I think a lot of this stuff is just for show, particularly the border guards.
Right, absolutely. Mike Hirsch, your thoughts on this?
Well, if you've ever seen a video of like a cat falling into a bathtub, that's what the that's what the Trump administration kind of reminds me of at this point. There's a lot of splashing and shrieking. And if you're not careful, you're going to get scratched. So it's hard to really interpret a cat falling into a bathtub. It's hard to interpret what's going on in the White House.
Yeah, and especially in the context of organization, you know, look at it and think that this is an organized group that they've got these strategic plans and they're using particular tactics in the interest of this overall strategy. No, that ain't how they do things.
And
they wake
up
every morning
people
and
people too,
right?
Yeah,
they're like what do we do now?
Yeah, CIA, Sally Yates, all these different people. I mean, it seems like the chances of like Obama having had like left behind guerrilla units to undermine Trump seems a little ridiculous to me on so many different aides. I mean, I think different people may be motivated. I think obviously the intelligence community is motivated, but I don't think it's connected to like, you know, all the different pieces. So that being said, though, one thing that was interesting to me also from yesterday, obviously, that I wanted to get into is the press conference. I mean, great TV. I was thinking halfway through, like, man, I wish I owned a television station. But nevertheless, I mean, his aides apparently didn't want him to do this press conference. And I certainly understand why. Like, anyone who is like a media professional, it's sort of like you don't want to unleash someone who you never know what they're going to say. But I also found myself saying that, like, you know, for his base, I think this helped him. Yep. I mean, there's enough truth in a lot of what he says, even if the way he says it is crazy, that like you can sort of parse it and interpret it in ways that I think, you know, are helpful to him. So I'm curious you guys' thoughts. Mike, I'll start with you. You are a national communications director of an organization. So, I mean, I wonder how you approach this.
Well, I actually listened to it on the radio, so you don't get to see him. Mm. And you hear that. It sounded better probably than it looked. What I was fascinated with was his kind of science guy explanation of uranium. Mm. That's something I'm still trying to figure out what he was talking about. But apparently Hillary Clinton loaded up a bunch of uranium in some suitcases and brought them over to Moscow. I'm still not sure exactly what he was trying to talk about there. But I do think, like you said, Eugene, that this works really well for Trump's base. They love that kind of thing. He was making fun of the press. He was joking. He seemed to be kind of self-assured. And it was just, you know, continuation of his very successful campaign strategy, which is to appeal to the dumb people who really like him.
Mm.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's the point I was going to say. You know, it kind of reminds me of the campaign because people kept saying, well, that's ridiculous. That's stupid. That'll never work. People are never. And they woke up one day and Donald Trump was president.
Yeah, 306 electoral votes later.
Exactly. So the reality is this. It again, he continues to seem in his position as the anti-politician. You know, he is a reality show star. And if you turn on a, you know, Honey Boo Boo or whatever, that's the kind of thing you're going to get. And that's what people expect. And there are a lot of people who, you know, let's face it, there were a lot of people who supported the Ted Cruz's and the Rick Perry's and the Sarah Palin's of the world, who they saw as these aren't normal politicians. Right. They liked them for that reason. But this has worked for Donald Trump, and it has always worked for him. It worked for him on a top-rated TV show. It worked to get him elected. So from the perspective of Donald Trump, even though the people around him may be saying, well, you might want to tone it down a little bit, why would he tone it down? It's always worked.
Right. And I mean, I think the other thing that is sort of quietly in here too is the media is running a lot of stories that, like, journalistically are questionable. At least the way they're running them is questionable. Like, we definitely have proof that this happened because these random anonymous people are doing this. And then, like, halfway down, it's like, but they actually didn't even have proof of what we alleged in the first half of the article. Like, even if Trump is ridiculous, I think it's easy enough to say, like, well, man, like, the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, BuzzFeed, they're kind of setting themselves up by the way they report this.
Yeah, part of that is this. And, you know, it's something I mentioned during the campaign when CNN and MSNBC and all, you know, et al. Were condemning Trump and coming after Trump. And I kept saying, you know, they're reminding people that it's not Donald Trump who lied them into the Iraq war and lied them into, you know, who led them down the road of the Bush tax cuts and all these other things. It's not Donald Trump, it's you. So when CNN or MSNBC, et cetera, they make fun of Donald Trump, every time people look at them, they say, it's not him that we really hate.
Yeah.
It's you.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he is what he is. But you guys have been insidiously eating away at the fabric of our culture and our economy for years. And if you look at right now, if you look at the numbers, I will guarantee you this. The press, the mainstream press, has a lower approval rating than Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Considerably lower approval rating than Donald Trump.
Which I think he pointed out in the guise of them having a lower approval rating than Congress, which I thought was a nice little dig that he also took at Congress, this whole concept of like, oh, wow, like maybe Congress also is terrible without a, you know, legitimate thing, which I guess is true. Every institution in America now more than ever. And a minute before our first break here, Mike, but I think that also in and of itself speaks to Trump's success. People just distrust our institutions. So whether they like or don't like him, they can easily say, well, I might hate Trump, but like I still don't trust the New York Times.
Absolutely. A lot of people don't really want to get down deep into the policies and the data and the, you know, investigative journalism, which, you know, I don't think there is that much of that anymore. Mm. And they're making decisions from the seat of their pants. And that's what Trump does. So they identify with that. They identify with him. And he can't go wrong as long as that's his target audience. He keeps feeding them what they want.
Mm-hmm. Go to the next in 30 seconds.
And the fact of the matter is this. That's where their money is coming from. Mm. They said, we learned a lesson because we helped Trump get elected and all we did was, you know, played Trump all the time. We've learned our lesson. That was a mistake. So what do you do now? Oh, 24 hours of Trump.
That's right. That's right. Well, we are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. We're going to have more with both of our guests. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation, wrapping up the big news of the week with Garland Nixon, who's the host of News Views with Garland Nixon on WPFW 89.3 FM and also on the National Board of the ACLU, and Mike Hirsch, who's the National Communications Director at Progressive Democrats of America. Now, we were able to do an interview earlier with Congressman Dennis Kucinich. I was glad and very grateful to him, a very busy man, that I had the chance to ask him about the ongoing relationship between Russia, the United States, as well as the role of the intelligence community. So I wanted to let you guys listen to that and then get some of your responses as to Congressman Kucinich's thoughts on this news item. Congressman, I wanted to just get right into it here. I'm curious what some of your thoughts are with this ongoing situation between Russia and the United States, which obviously has been playing out in a big way this week with the removal or resignation of General Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor.
We are on the threshold of a new Cold War from inside the intelligence community and from some holdovers in the State Department. It is really dangerous to try to drive a wedge between the U.S. and Russia at a time when our countries ought to be working together for nuclear disarmament and for cooperation on a broad range of issues which are important to both nations. We have to recognize that what's happened to General Flynn, because of a concerted effort to try to thwart the new Trump's administration's attempt to have a good relationship with Russia. And so the demonization that's gone on, the attempt to paint any kind of U.S.-Russian contact as being sinister, needs to be challenged, and that's what I'm doing.
And I wonder, in looking how this is going, I mean, Democrats seem to be trying to latch onto this and use this as a way to move Trump out of the way. I mean, does this make logical sense to you, or should they be focused more on policy priorities and where maybe they can make a deal with Trump to push forward their agenda?
Well, look, I understand the disappointment of Democrats. The election didn't go the way that we wanted it to. But let's not throw ourselves in league with those who are trying to usurp a constitutionally elected government. This is, can we try to find some ways to work together? I'm sure. I mean, look, America survived many different administrations, and people have tried to find ways to come together. That's the nature of our government. We have strong disagreements, and we look for ways to work together. But what's happening in Washington that's different is that there are those who are suggesting that the new administration has nothing in common with the American people, which is rather odd since the new administration won a majority in the Electoral College. So, there's a hyper-partisanship that is so destructive, and it has fallout in international affairs. That Democratic leaders should be pandering to an anti-Russia crowd is disconcerting. And that's why I've chosen to speak out, because I think we have to remember that America's position in the world cannot be singular, that we have a multipolar world, that we're a nation among nations, and that we need to find ways of working together so that we can avoid conflict. We paid a horrible price for policies that have taken us into conflict in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, and elsewhere. We have to start to focus on things back here at home. But we can't do that if we're pitched into an ideological battle with Russia, and if which would revisit the Cold War. And we can't do that if we fall prey to those who want to keep our government in turmoil. And so, it's time for us to look behind the scenes to find out who these elements are who are trying to destabilize our government, to bring them forward and into broad daylight.
Absolutely. Well, and I know you're a very busy man, so I appreciate you giving us that time and those words, Congressman. That was former Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who is very active still here politically on a number of important issues. Thank you so much, Congressman, for joining us today. And that was an interview we were able to get earlier with former Congressman Dennis Kucinich on a lot of the issues with Mike Flynn, the CIA, NSA, Russia, elections, deal. Garland Nixon, some of your reactions perhaps to some or all of what the Congressman had to say.
Sure. I'm in agreement with him 100%. He's making, basically the argument that I've been making also, and that a lot of progressives have been making, and that what's disconcerting, number one, is the anti-Russia sentiment and the attempt to rekindle the Cold War. But what's even more concerning to me as a lifelong Democrat is that the Democratic Party is that it's so bipartisan, right? And I think two reasons. Number one, the foundation for this particular paradigm is based on the fact that the mainstream of the Democratic Party does not want to admit that Hillary lost. They can't say Hillary lost because they can't say that Hillary's policies were rejected, the neoliberal policies, and particularly her foreign policy of interventionism. And, you know, and hegemony, they can't admit that those policies were rejected. So number one, they have to say Hillary didn't lose, it was stolen. But number two, and there's a bigger issue, and I'm an anti-Trump guy, but here's the other issue, one of the reasons that it's bipartisan. Because Donald Trump went outside of the two-party system to win. Because Donald Trump didn't win because he's a Republican. He won, but he didn't win the Republican nomination, and he didn't win all those Republican votes because he's a Republican. He won because he wasn't. They rejected their establishment. The Democrats rejected their establishment, but the Democratic establishment stole it from him, basically. But he went outside of it, and he has now demonstrated and is demonstrating in his own warped kind of way, that the two-party system, to some extent, is vulnerable to a populist approach, and that if someone comes along with a reasonably sane, if a reasonably sane populist comes along, he's going to blow the two-party system to smithereens. And all the billions that Hillary got, she spent like $1 billion, he spent like $50 million. It isn't even about money. So their argument about money doesn't work. And he is a threat to their political power. And I think that's one of the reasons that it's so bipartisan against him. And what else are they going to use but the Russians? Because they did it to themselves. They got to blame somebody.
No, I think you're 100% right. I mean, honestly, I think it's dumb that they're doing it. But if I was Robbie Mook, I'd be blaming Russia, too. I'd be blaming China. I'd be blaming Iran. I would blame every person I could possibly find not to get beyond the fact that, especially because what was interesting to me, too, Mike, was like it'd be one thing if you just didn't know. But throughout the whole primary, they have people who are very well-known people like Stan Greenberg. Mm-hmm. There's that one famous of the one of the emails is like 5,000 words long. And he's like, here are the results of all of the polling I've done in all of these areas where Trump will probably do well, blah, blah, blah. Like, this is what you need to do to beat Bernie. This is what you need to do to, like, take on the Republicans, blah, blah, blah. There was a gentleman, Steve Hildebrand, who we had on the show once, who worked for Obama in 08. He wrote Podesta like, hey, don't know what you're thinking right now. I don't know why you're doing this. Here's another example. So it was like they not only had a bad strategy, but at no point in the campaign ever seemed to seriously consider that, you know, maybe other people had a point, and here they go. So, yeah, I agree with Garland. What else can they do but blame Russia? But some of your takeaways, Mike, from what the congressman had to say.
Well, it always amazes me how brilliant Dennis Kucinich is, how he speaks in these complete thoughts, and he has an amazing understanding of the dynamics that are going on. And it's a real coup that you had him on, and I always appreciate hearing what he has to say. And I do think that he's right. He touched on the disappointment of Democrats. Democrats are disappointed that Trump's in there, but as you just quoted, a whole lot of experts who warned Podesta and these other people, you had a candidate who never really won a contested primary, never really won a difficult election. She became a senator in New York State because the entire power apparatus lined up behind her, cleared the field for her in the primary, let her run unopposed. She probably would have lost to Giuliani the first time, but the man got sick, so she ran against Rick Lazio, who was like not ready for prime time.
No.
And then she ran against somebody even worse the second time. And then, you know, she had every advantage in the world, all these leads against Obama. He beat her in Iowa and just beat her by running a better campaign. She seems to run campaigns that are about her and not the voters. She heard so much about glass ceilings and things, so one woman could be successful and all the other women were supposed to come out for that. White women voted for Trump more than for Hillary Clinton. She is a white woman. She needs to have that constituency. So for somebody who ran away from her career as pro-fracking and, you know, pro-Henry Kissinger and all these other things, and she was running away from her record trying to do identity politics— they didn't even get identity politics right. She lost to an erratic person who was, you know, part of why Trump's White House is in such bad shape is that all the qualified people ditched his campaign. They said, this is a disaster. I don't want to be involved with this. So he's, you know, surrounded by a bunch of bloggers and retreads and also rants. You know, he's not even with the B team, the C team, D team. He's, like, you know, with the X, Y, or Z team. And they still beat Hillary Clinton in the Great Lakes region, where, you know, she had to really try to lose those. And, you know, it's to me, I don't think disappointment's the right word for that. It should be, you know, you mentioned Robbie Mook. Why, you know, why has an adult man called himself Robbie? You know, that's a little bit of a concern for me. It's time to grow up and be a little serious if you're going to run a national campaign.
Right.
That's just me. And Mook, you can't really do too much about that, but you chose the Robbie, so that's not good. You know, you're looking at two parties in disarray, as Garland kind of implied. Trump ran on a wave of political petulance, and because we weren't able to support a progressive populist and Bernie Sanders, that opportunity was taken away from us. Petulance overcame the insiders, the establishment, because the establishment is very unpopular. They've been taking care of their own and screwing over everybody else. Now everybody else is angry.
No, I think that's a great point. And again, I mean, where do they even pick Robbie Mook? I mean, his only success had been Terry McAuliffe in Virginia, which, you know, look, people can say whatever they want to say. I think that was not a very difficult race for Democrats to win, certainly not in that state, and I think they'll win next time around. But either way, Garland, go ahead.
And here's the other part. Why the Russians, you might ask? Well, you know, the legacy of the Clintons are the Cold War Democrats.
Right.
That's their legacy, Cold War Democrats. Because right now, see, what happened in America? So we've got a lot of, we've got a military-industrial complex that needs money. Mm-hmm. They want money. They want all of the money, right? So for years, the Republicans said, for the last several years, while it's the Muslims, it's Islam, it's, you know, we got to spend money, more money because of that. So now what we've got is this. We've got a dynamic where we've got the right wing of America saying, hey, you know, we got to spend money and we've got to increase the military spending because of Islamofascism, phobia, et cetera. Right. Meanwhile, we got the Clintonistas, the centrists are going to say, well, we've got to increase military spending because of the Russians. Well, what are we going to have? We're going to have a bipartisan agreement. Mm. I see it coming. When this budget comes, they're going to say, we've got to increase military spending because of the Islamo/Russian, you know. So each side is going to have their reason to give the money to their military-industrial complex cronies and to agree that we've got to cut social programs and cut the social safety net. And so that's what really frost my cookies, as it were, about the centrists and the Democrats being there, is they're just coming up, they're building the case. You know Donald Trump is going to want to increase military spending, and he's going to want to cut social safety programs, and they are helping to build the case with this phony, false, you know, Russian boogeyman. Mm-hmm. That's their latest boogeyman, and the Clintons had to reach back to the 80s to find an old boogeyman because they don't have a decent one now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good point how the issue of cutting the military-industrial complex in any way, shape, or form has totally dropped out of the Democratic platform. I mean, I can't remember if Gore had it in 2000, but obviously Clinton famously ran in 92 on the peace dividend from the Cold War ending. Whatever happened to that? I certainly don't know. Maybe if he was as reliable as Apple in giving out his dividends, we'd be okay here. But, I mean, really just sort of an interesting shift that the Republicans have used this talking point so obsessively in the past three elections, 08, 2012, 2016. The American military is hollowed out. It has to be rebuilt, which is the craziest, fakest thing I've ever heard.
And they lost twice doing it.
They lost
so
twice
we know
doing
it's
it.
Not a valid argument.
And so you'd think even for pure opportunism, the Democrats would throw in a little bit of that. But it was, again, Donald Trump who, while arguing that the military should be bigger, still in a very interesting contradiction, still was a big advocate for cutting the waste in the military spending. And I'm just like, not only is he having his cake and eating it too, but the Democrats aren't taking this extraordinarily obvious opportunity to attack him on this issue, war and peace issues, military-industrial complex. Not taking the advice of PDA, that's for sure, Mike.
Absolutely. One of our tenets is, and we were largely created after the Kucinich presidential campaign, so we're obviously going to be in agreement with him. One of our watchwords is we should cut military spending, definitely bring people home from all these bases that we have in just about every country in the world, and stay out of other people's squabbles. You know, we were just reading earlier today, we're reading an article about a poor child getting his legs blown off by a bomb in Syria, and the neoliberal and conservative answer to that is, we'll drop more bombs on them. Mm. You know, if you're talking about bombing people because they've been bombed, you know that you're going in the wrong direction. And Garland implied this has to do with the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about, not just in his farewell address famously, but several times during his administration. What did he know? He only helped us win World War II.
Right.
But we have is these corporations that are guaranteed a certain percentage of profit based on how much money they waste or spend. So we've got every kind of economic incentive perverted in that, and they're guaranteed these profits, and they keep pouring money into elections, and then the politicians who are elected keep pouring money back into their coffers in a vicious cycle. We must break the cycle. And people are homeless without health care, without education, without jobs in our country. And we keep throwing more money and looking for more enemies to create to point our weapons at or drop bombs on. It's just immoral. It's wrong. And it's not sustainable in any way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really fascinating for people to read and to look into how the Department of Defense was created. Most people don't really realize there was no large standing army till after World War II. There was nothing like the CIA or anything right. like that. And the way the military, the corporations who'd been getting all the money for war industries came together with the foreign policy establishment, saying more or less using the idea that the United States is the greatest country that should police the whole world to institutionalize this massive military, industrial, congressional foreign policy complex that has wreaked so much havoc in so many different ways, and we're coming, I think we have about a minute till our next break here, 2 minutes till our next break here, Garland, but I raise that because it also is interesting how this is being used as a wedge issue against Tulsi Gabbard, because she went to Syria, Congressman Kucinich was on that trip as well, and, you know, she was the only person in Congress to go to Standing Rock, someone who endorsed Bernie Sanders at great risk to her own career, mm-hmm. had to resign from the Democratic National Committee, and now this sort of war and peace issues, the war issue, being used as a wedge, say, oh, she's not a real progressive because she allegedly is some supporter of Bashar al-Assad, which in and of itself is not really true.
Right. And so what we're looking at now is we've got a lot of people that are looking for wedge issues. I think one of the things we got to watch out for is that the establishment Democrats, the centrists, are looking for ways to divide progressives, just to keep pointing to people to say this person is that person is not a real progressive. And what it comes down to, and I think we'll see it over the course of the next couple years, will be votes for the budget. When it comes down to military budget, when it comes down to cutting safety programs, all the talk is good, but who's going to vote? For all of the Cory Booker running around screaming at airports against you know, Muslim deportation, et cetera. But when it came time to vote for pharmaceutical industries, he was right there for the top 1%. And that's the question we're going to see.
Yeah, absolutely. He was at the Peace Ball, you know, all of a sudden showing up at all the protests. But he knew where he was, where he needed to land. I have to say the pharmaceutical industry also probably has some of the greatest PR because everyone's always on Wall Street. But I would say that they are – equally as predatory, if not worse in some ways. Like you could make a legitimate argument that some of what they do on Wall Street is like benign to some degree, whatever. But I'm pretty sure that commodifying drugs people need to live is like not logical. It doesn't really make much sense to me. It doesn't do anything. And it just makes you wonder, you know, Mike, about 30 seconds till our next break here. I mean, should single payer healthcare become one of the leading issues for Democrats in this Trump era?
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, in about a week, we're going to be having demonstrations all around the country on behalf of John Conyers, H.R. 676, the expanded and improved Medicare for All legislation, which, as every economist, every healthcare professional has looked at this and said, it will both save lives and save money.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are going to take another break here on By Any Means Necessary in Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We're going to be back with more in our next segment with both of our guests. So stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our end-of-the-week wrap-up of all the big issues here with Garland Nixon, who's the host of News Views with Garland Nixon on WPFW 89.3 FM, and Mike Hirsch, who's the National Communications Director at Progressive Democrats of America. And during the break, we got started a little bit on more conservative Democrats in relationship to the point that Garland was making towards the end there, which I think is very relevant, which, you know, despite the fact that obviously I think at this stage in the game, the Democratic base is as far to the left as it's been in some time, not ever, but certainly in some time, and everyone is kind of pandering towards that, but many of these people who are still in there you know, whatever, are still very pro-corporate. So, you know, I wanted to talk about this Joe Manchin character, the senator from West Virginia. So he voted today for Scott Pruitt, the EPA nominee, the head of the EPA administrator here, who, for those who don't know, is the attorney general of Oklahoma, hates the EPA. So Fox hen house situation. And it turned out Manchin has voted for every single one of the Trump nominees except for Betsy DeVos. Now, I don't know if he's setting himself up to switch parties. I don't know what's going on here, but it does seem, and Heidi Heitkamp also voted for Pruitt today, that what we may start to see here, Garland, is similar to the Bush years, a coterie of Democratic senators who sort of try to attach their political fortunes to the tail of a popular Republican president.
You know, let's face the reality. You know, we've always had the blue dog Democrats. We've always had the right wing Democrats, that, you know, the Ben Nelsons, the Mary Landrieus, et cetera. But I think what they better be concerned about is this. Look what happened to the Republican Party over the course of the Obama administration. You know, a lot of Republicans got all freaked out that there was a black president. And basically, they dragged the party to the left. You know, the more right wing you were, any of the fairly moderate, if there was such a thing, but there was a few moderates, they wiped them all out. And the people who weren't more pure lost their seats. The Democrats better be concerned about that, because the Joe Manchins, the Heidi Heitkamps, et cetera, these people are going to be facing an angry, in 2018 and 2020, an angry and rabid base who's going to show up. And you're going to see some of these people get knocked out in the primaries. You're going to see some of these people get a surprise because they are not in touch at all with what their base is. You know, it's funny. To me, the first sign was Cory Booker. Cory Booker went around and did all of the, you know, stood up for the usual things that a Democrat is supposed to stand up for. And then he voted in favor of the pharmaceutical industry, and he didn't see it coming. Man, the heat came down on this guy, you know, like the blaze of a thousand suns, and he didn't see it coming. I think a lot of these people have yet to recognize the shift in dynamics and the actual anger of their base. And I think it'll be up going into 2018 and 2020. Some of these Joe Manchins and these people are going to get knocked out in the primaries, and they're going to be shocked because they didn't read the tea leaves and see what happened to the Republicans.
No, I think that's 100% correct. I mean, it seems like, you know, the Politics 101, you got to build from your base out, Mike. I mean, and I was doing a little research just to see how this kind of thing works when you message not towards your base, but someone else. I looked at the Bush tax cuts because I remember many, you know, Democrats that supported that. Now, many people, especially our younger listeners, will not know that not that long ago, this is 2001, Georgia had two Democratic senators, Zell Miller, who at one time was like the New South guy, and Max Cleland, who is a veteran, well-known guy, had directed Veteran Affairs under Carter. Both of them voted for the Bush tax cuts. Both of those seats are now Republicans. I could kind of go on and on down the line here. There's some people who no one would even want to even talk about. It was Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas, also voted for them. Cole in Wisconsin. You know, just almost all these seats of these people have now turned over. Bill Nelson have turned over to Republicans. So it seems like, you know, they didn't take care of home. They didn't take care of their base. People didn't believe in them. And then why would a Republican vote for a Democrat when they could just vote for a Republican?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the oldest thing in politics. If you don't fire up your base and have your base enthusiastic, you're not going to win. And what occurred to me is, and a lot of people on social media are still blaming Bernie Sanders for what he did. Well, what did he do? There were a lot of people out there who were so depressed about the Democratic Party, they felt there was no point in even coming out and voting for him. They got fired up by Barack Obama's campaign in 08 especially, and they were disappointed. He didn't do a single payer. He didn't do a public option. Spent a lot of time chasing around one or two Republican women trying to get them on the bill. Meanwhile, a whole lot of opportunities went away. Card check didn't get passed for our brothers and sisters in the labor movement. So many other things just didn't get done. The stimulus bill was largely tax cuts and not actual investment in people that would have really revitalized the economy. Now, I don't say that Obama was terrible, did everything wrong, but there were missed opportunities and people became depressed. When Bernie came around, he spoke to people's depression. He spoke to people in terms of, you know, don't give up. We come out in the millions. We can make things happen. That depression turned to enthusiasm. Then when the revelations came with WikiLeaks that the DNC had stolen it from Bernie, that sentiment turned back to anger. And what we have is a lot of angry people out there. They're not going to take lowered expectations. That's They're right. not going to take double talk from Democrats or Republicans, and they demand something better.
And the real question, Garland, is why would they? I mean, the Tea Party rose up, took over the Republican Party. There was a great article about this. I think it was in the Post that was talking about John Boehner going to the Tea Party rally with Kevin McCarthy in 2010 and being real happy and being, I'm all for you guys, keep doing it. Then the next thing you know, Eric Cantor, all of them, they took them out. And even to this day, and I mean, you actually see it that Mick Mulvaney, who is the budget director of Trump, actually drew opposition from John McCain because he has such a strong Tea Party position on the debt. He said there should be strong caps on Pentagon spending. So, I mean, these people came in. They more or less took over. They certainly set the tone. I mean, I forget the exact number. You might be able to remind me that the grand bargain of Obama and Boehner was like tax cuts 10 to 1 for tax cuts. I mean, really, no person could have asked for like a better compromise than John Boehner. And the Tea Party people said, nope, we going 100% or that's it. Now a radical right wing administration is in the White House. Radical right wing administrations control almost every state house in America. Radical right wing people control both houses of Congress. I mean, it seems, and even the ones who aren't radical right wing people are so scared of the radical right wing people. They just say, hey, I'm in it for the free healthcare and, you know, the, you know, Marco Rubio's Center of Government Affairs. You're right. When I get out of here. So I'm riding with the Tea Party.
Yeah. But, you know, what happens with these people, with you know, the Clintons, the Joe Manchins, et cetera, there's no way around it. If we go historically back to, you know, Scoop Jackson, if we go, again, back to the Cold War Democrats, what do they always do? In 1985, they started the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council. Why? Because they thought that the Democratic Party should move to the right. We got to be Republican light. That is their legacy. That's what they believe. And no matter, they went with Gore. And Joe Lieberman,
right?
You couldn't find anybody. Zell Miller was about the only person in the Democratic Party to the right of Joe Lieberman.
I know. And Hillary and then Clinton spoke at the Democratic, Republican National Committee in 2004.
Yeah, and nobody lambasted the Democrats like Zell Miller. What did Hillary Clinton do? She went out and got Tim Kaine. Mm-hmm. So the reality is that's who these people are. We've got to accept that they are people who believe the Democratic Party should move to the right, and that what they always have wanted to do is to purge the Democratic Party of progressives, to shift it to the right, and to pick up moderates. In fact, Chuck Schumer was the giveaway, because Chuck Schumer said, for every Democrat that we lose in Western Pennsylvania, we will pick up two Republicans in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And you can repeat that in Wisconsin and Michigan. So what he said was, we get rid of the working class, we get rid of these darn progressives, and then we pick up the moderates, and hooray, we got it all. But no matter how many times they lose, they're like Lucy with the football. Mm-hmm. They just keep coming back saying, you know, what we did probably is, it wasn't that we moved too far to the right. We didn't move quite far enough to the right. Mm-hmm. If we move a little bit more to the right, well, it'll surely work this time.
Yeah, and you know, I think too, Mike, it also speaks to a lot of what voters want these days, which is credibility. I mean, I think about like Alison Lunder and Grimes in Kentucky, who wouldn't even say who she voted for because everyone knew she voted for Obama. Like, I mean, it was just, there was no question at all that she must have voted for Barack Obama. She had said positive things about the guy. Her positions on a lot of issues were very similar. And the White House, I think, stupidly enough, agreed with these people when they said, oh, run away from me, run away from me. But like, if I'm a voter in Kentucky, a Republican, moderate Republican, and I'm thinking, okay, I like Lunder and Grimes, these Rand Paul type people, they're doing too much. It's too much. But if she can't even admit that she voted for Barack Obama and justified it to me, how could I really trust her to do anything?
Well, let me throw this out quick too. And their issue was focusing on trying to steal a few Republicans, when the issue is this. More importantly, if I'm a Democrat in Kentucky and you won't even admit that you voted, see, right, the issue is you ain't going to get those Republicans anyway. If I'm a Democrat, I'm like, well, why should I show up and vote for you? I don't even know if you voted for Obama.
Right.
So what they don't understand is there's three things that you got to do to win. Number one, turn out your base. Number two, you know, you've heard me say it, turn out your base. Number three, turn out your base. They don't get it. That's why Barack Obama continually won, because he always turned out his base.
Absolutely. He took care of home. He was not an idiot. I mean, he obviously just recognized that, like, okay, there are certain people who will never vote for me. Some of those people who may be on the fence, I might get, but I will only get them, it will only matter if they vote for me, if I have the overwhelming majority. And it's just like, you know, you look at a state like Michigan, everyone talking about white collar vote, white people who are blue collar voters, and that's relevant. Don't get me wrong. But I'm thinking about, what about black working class voters? In Flint, in Detroit, they did not show up in pretty significant numbers for Hillary Clinton. And it wasn't because they loved Trump. We know that much. And it couldn't have possibly been that they even preferred him. It had to have been that they just felt that on balance, she wouldn't do enough to make it worth it, even though they have voted for Obama twice, even though, as you mentioned, Mike, he didn't even do that much.
Now, let's not forget this. And this was important. And I got to give Obama a little bit of blame, too. Mm. The arrogance of the Democratic Party. During the presidential campaign, the most disliked policy, hated policy on both sides of the aisle was the TPP. Yeah. And the head of the Democratic Party, Barack Obama, was running around saying, how are we going to force the TPP through before Hillary gets in? How are we going to do it in a lame duck? Let me ask you this. Do you think, had he went in the other direction, that maybe Hillary would have got another 1% in Florida and in Michigan and another 11,000 votes in Michigan? That maybe, I'm not saying it's his fault. I'm saying all these factors alone, that's one of the factors. You lose 1% because of the TPP, because the president's running around saying, hey, let's do the TPP.
Yeah. No,
it was absurd.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, absolutely having to run against your own president on any number of issues. I mean, the other thing that was sort of quiet as it was kept is Hillary Clinton was trying to move to his left on the movement for black lives and trying to be more aggressive around police violence than he was willing to be. And at the time, the first black president is sort of telling people, calm down, don't do too much. She's trying to see if she can glide off.
She had hot sauce in her purse. Let's not forget that. I mean, come on.
You have to get black people. Of dominoes.
Yeah, I'm surprised she didn't have chitlins and some watermelon in there, too. She might as well if she's going to
insult black people. If she would have thought she was losing, she probably would have.
Yeah, you're right.
She just thought she was winning, so she just did the bare minimum.
Got a bigger purse for those watermelons.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, the whole thing is just, I mean, just circling back around to the original ridiculousness of it and to, I think, the reality of the situation here. You know, even if you look at this DNC race, none of them want to grapple with the real reason why they lost. I mean, like, they're sort of dancing around the edges. But really, even Keith Ellison, who I think is basically cool, you know, I don't think he's going to do that much. I don't think it's possible to reclaim the Democrats. But that being said, even he's kind of going party unity, so on and so forth. And I just think that, like, at the end of the day, until they just call out how ridiculous this is, they'll never get to the bottom of it.
Can I take a little different position on Keith Ellison?
Please.
Here's what I think about Keith Ellison. I think Keith Ellison is smart. Mm. See, don't forget, I think Keith Ellison does really want to make changes and will, because he's a progressive guy. However, he still needs a bunch of Clintonites to vote for him to win, doesn't he? So right now, in the heat of the race, if he stands up and says, these son of a gun stole it, we've been robbed, we've been had, all of these Clinton people that maybe he can steal a few here and get that, you know, the number that he needs, right, are all going to run. I think right now, if I were running right now, as furious as I am about what happened in the primaries, I'd back away from that till after I won. After I won, now you're going to get a whole different story.
Well, and Mike, is the subtext of this DNC race to some degree also similar to the primary on the issue of sort of internal democracy? And I just, it keeps crazy. It's only 447 people who are going to vote. But obviously, the way they're running the race, no DNC chairperson is actually messaging to the people who are running. They're messaging to voters. They're collecting, you know, big amounts of signatures. They're doing big public campaigns. It's like a congressional race. And I just thought, like, that's an interesting, you know, we talk so much about the primaries being undemocratic, is true. But, like, it seems like that's also a subtext too here, is should the person picked to run the Democratic Party just be appointed by a president or these, you know, random leaders, or should there be more of a primary?
And I can't remember DNC chair election being this scrutinized or this wide open or this, you know, kind of public. It's always been kind of, you know, backfield deal, you know, kind of behind the scenes. And, you know, most times people just shrug, okay, so it's going to be Terry McAuliffe, it's going to be Chris Dodd, it's going to be, you know, Howard Dean, whoever. Now, with Howard Dean, there were a lot of people who supported him in the primaries and also supported him for the DNC. And that's what I'm seeing Keith Ellison trying to do. Garland and I were both in Baltimore campaigning for Keith. Full disclosure, Progressive Democrat supports Keith Ellison. He's on our advisory board. We love him. We were there. Howard Dean's brother, Jim Dean, was there stumping for Keith. And from what we're hearing is the majority of the people who are actually going to vote on this in Maryland support Keith Ellison.
Baltimore City Council supported.
Baltimore City Council does.
Very relevant, because Perez is from Maryland.
That's right. So Keith Ellison's taking care of business. He's running a very smart campaign, which he did in every time he's run for office in Minnesota. He turned a very underperforming district into the best performing district in the state, not just for himself, but for every Democrat running in that district. They always overperformed. He's one of the smartest, most astute, people. But part of it is goes back to what you were saying, Eugene. He is a genuine person. Mm. There's nobody who doubts Keith Ellison believes what he's saying and says what he believes. And he does it in an engaging way, in a non-judgmental way, in an inclusive way. But he has that sincerity and that integrity that I think voters are really craving.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's a lot of what I think the Tom Perez candidacy certainly seems to lack. I mean, it just seems like unbelievable astroturf. I mean, I hate to just like rip on a guy who I don't even know and who, like, as far as I know, has never done anything that would like drive me crazy. But at the end of the day, it just sort of seems like, man, how much more transparent could you be that this is to, it's just like when Wesley Clark got against Howard Dean in the 2004 Democratic primary. It's so clear that it's a stop somebody candidate. I mean, I just don't see how someone like that could win, because it'll be so clearly angering to the base.
Yeah, yes. I think this is a critical period for the Democratic Party right now, because the party is fractured. The party is clearly fractured. And we have a bunch of people with their heads in the sand pretending that we are all have a united opposition against Trump. And when in fact progressives see it as an anti-Trump, not really a coalition, that there are people that say, I'm opposed to Trump and his policies and his racism, bigotry, and xenophobia. And then there are other people who are saying, I'm anti-Trump in service to the status quo. Mm. I'm opposed to Trump and it's Russia and Hillary didn't lose. So there's, you know, so there is a clear fracture between the two, and the mainstream Democrats are pretending as though they can just put Tom Perez, a pro-TPP guy from the Obama administration in, and everything will flow smoothly and we can continue to talk about how bad the Russians were and vote for, you know, to cut the things we always cut that hurt the Murphy class.
You mentioned the DLC, and I think what's been going on in the Democratic Party for some time is there are these neoliberals who are not neo, nor are they liberal. Huh. They're just plain old conservatives. They still support trickle-down corporatism, yep, but with a little bit less bigotry on the side. Mm. That's really all they are. They're just a
small side of bigotry instead of the super side.
Exactly. Instead of the super size that you get on the Republican side.
Well, thank you so much to Mike Hirsch and Garland Nixon for joining us here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. on this Friday. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next week.
By any means necessary.